we see a huge potential for market growth for international cross-channel rail services, you know, up to 50% in the next few years.
We have to decide as a country how much we're willing to spend on the railway, whether we want that to be subsidised or not. And I think only the government can make that decision.
I think we should all remember Cyril Intercity. He was the first true intercity director of a business, and I was the final one. I had to shut it down before closure, and only then did I realise how much Cyril had done for us.
Welcome to Rail News. This time we discuss the rights and wrongs of financing the railway, and who should decide what is right. We visit Market Harborough for an update on Midland Main Line electrification before it was paused, ask how international open access can work when there's so little spare capacity at Temple Mills, find out what happened on the railway when a major freight shipper changed ports, uncover the inside story of the Railway 200 exhibition train, and remember a railway innovator who changed the face of Intercity. But we begin with a long-standing challenge, how to make the railway more accessible. Transreport is a specialist company developing accessibility technology. And I spoke to the company's founder, Jay Shen, and his colleague Emma Partlow, who's Director of Consumer Engagement and Policy, after they'd hosted a summit in London in May to coincide with Global Accessibility Awareness Day. Jay Shen says railway accessibility should be a priority.
It is the disabled people's right to be able to travel and use the railway network. It is not something that we should consider, oh, it's, we're doing something nice, or, you know, we're helping people. No, this is where we talk about equality and equity. Everybody has the right to travel whenever they want to, wherever they want to. I think changing that mindset and culture is the most critical part.
There's still quite a narrow definition of disability when we think about people's access needs and the barriers that exist. And I think a big challenge and certainly an opportunity for the rail industry is to really broaden out what we think about when we think about accessibility. We should really move away from these notions of fully accessible and look at impairments and access needs as just part of the human condition, whether somebody has an impairment, they have a chronic illness, or maybe they've just got a temporary injury or illness. We need to really broaden out what we think about when we think about the words disability, access needs, and accessibility. So I would be inclined to agree that, you know, that isn't something we can think about, and we shouldn't be thinking about fully accessible railways. We should be thinking about how can we break down barriers? How can we best support and meet people's individual access needs? Because what is accessible for one person may be wholly inaccessible to another person.
Looking abroad for a moment, you've been doing work in Japan with a new passenger assistance web. Sounds fine. What does it do?
For the first time, we'll be giving disabled passenger in Japan the chance to communicate their access need in advance of their travel so that the train companies can be more prepared, be more aware of what the individual needs, what they need to prepare to facilitate the service. Especially the challenge in Japan is that more and more stations become unstaffed due to multiple various reasons. And having this capacity, allowing the passengers to communicate their access need beforehand, allowing train company to manage the situation so they can send a staff to the temporary unstaffed station to really serve the customer. It's this big change in the customer currently how disabled people using the railway in Japan.
The government has paused further work on Midland Main Line electrification north of Wigston, and protests have been lodged with Rail Minister Lord Hendy. But before that announcement was made earlier this month, Phil Marsh went to Market Harborough to meet Gavin Crook, principal programme sponsor, on the day that completion of electrification north of Kettering as far as Wigston was being celebrated.
We've had now three stages to the electrification programme. So London to Corby, you can probably recall that we had a massive success with the £1 billion programme, delivered on time, under budget, and built a lot of good partnership engagements with our suppliers, as well as then our working arrangements for doing continuous production line approach to overhead line.
And that's the key to the efficiency, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And the Corby thing, if I remember rightly, wasn't just electrification, it was track as well, wasn't it?
Yes.
And the difference there is this is mainly electrification, isn't it?
Yes. So we've basically got two more stages that have been the follow-on electrification from Kettering, so where we finished off on London to Corby. We got partway through approval, so construction started back in 2022, and halfway through the construction year, so towards back end of 2022-2023, we got agreement with the Department for Transport, looked at our efficiencies and the way that we were doing that production line approach to electrification, and was able to double the amount of electrified line up to Wigston. So partway through our work that we were doing with our suppliers, we had a look at our power supply, which is up at Braybrook.
I was going to mention that because that turned out to be very convenient, didn't it?
It was. I think we fortuitously had a good arrangement with National Grid, got a big bulk supply point that was at a touch point around Market Harbour where we are today. And when we did the full assessment of the new trains and how they can use the power and what amount of power is needed to actually run this section of line, we knew that we'd be able to get more out of that power supply and go further on up the network.
So there'll be no voltage dips? Like over Beatwick and Chaffert?
No.
19,000 volts.
So all of the things that we've been doing has been doing the best practice and lessons from all of the different electrification programmes. We've done a lot of share on what we've done from the past projects like Great Western, also good engagement with our Scottish colleagues as well that have been doing the continuous electrification. And I think there's now getting to a point, what we've just delivered on Kettering to Wigston is best in class nationally.
Gavin Crook, principal programme sponsor for Midland Mainline Electrification, which is to stop at Wigston for now. The decision to pause further electrification was inevitably a financial one. Although critics say pausing the work will cost as much as £70 million and also risk economic benefits of nearly £400 million. But the railway has to be paid for. The question is who should be the paymaster? And Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander has expressed concern that railway subsidies are still running at £2 billion a year. Consultants Arthur D. Little have published a new report looking ahead to the creation of Great British Railways after hosting a round table with industry leaders. Stephen Watson and Marcus Beard worked on this study, and they concluded the decision about finance cannot be made within the industry.
I think the railway itself cannot decide what we want. I think we were clear we want the railway to carry passengers and to carry freight, but how much of each has to be a public policy. Once that's set, the railway needs to find ways of delivering that at a price we can afford as a society, because to offer that as a product at an unaffordable price doesn't help society or the railway, and then just creates this tension we have between income and expenditure.
I think the conclusion that some people might reach from that is that we have traditionally expected our railways to make money, all the way back to Dr. Beeching recommending closures by the bucket load in the 1960s. It was all about reducing the railway deficit. But other European countries don't take that view. They accept that passenger railways don't make a profit. They are of benefit to society. So how far can we go, and who is wrong, the other European countries or Great Britain?
It's a really good point. I think the issue is it's not just about how much you spend. It's about how productive that spend is. You know, there's lots of talk at the moment about the NHS similarly, isn't there, where, you know, we can keep spending more money on the NHS, but unless that delivers primary care to patients, what's the point? And I think we've got the same in rail. There's quite a lot in our article about the productivity issues around maintenance teams and in utilization of drivers. So it's not just about the spend, it's about making sure that spend actually delivers. I don't think there's a right or wrong. It's up to the country, isn't it? This is a national railway. It's not particularly an international railway, apart from the link over into continental Europe. We have to decide as a country how much we're willing to spend on the railway, whether we want that to be subsidised or not. And I think only the government can make that decision. I don't think that's a decision that should be left to GBR specifically, for example. It has to be decided at a national level what we're willing to spend.
Stephen Watson and Marcus Beard of Arthur D. Little. The Chartered Institution of Railway Operators is 25, and to celebrate the anniversary, Phil Marsh went to Waterloo Station in London to see a GBRF loco named for the institution again. GBRF Chief Executive John Smith says time has moved on since the institution gained its first nameplate on the same locomotive 17 years ago.
Since we last did it in 2008, same loco, the institution has become chartered, and you can now get a professional qualification by studying with the Institute of Rail Operators. It's also its 25th anniversary since it was first founded by Gordon Pettit, God rest his soul, back in the late 90s. So it's been a great event to celebrate.
And you mentioned in your little speech about having to change paths for some of your freight services to a different London freight terminal.
Yeah, we've had a bit of turmoil, Phil. We've had one of the biggest shippers in the world, Maersk, decided to move their ships from Felixstowe down to London Gateway. Now, clearly that was a shipside decision, but to match it, all the landside, be it road or rail, had to be moved to suit. And that hasn't been easy, so because it was at very short notice. So finding capacity on what is a lot busier railway on the LT&S into London, finding space around the Gospel Oak Barking, finding space on the North London, has been a real challenge for us. And actually it's a challenge for Network Rail as we go forward. The port is investing hugely in building a new dock. Almost £1 billion is going into it. They're also building a new rail freight terminal there, which is great to see because it'll encourage rail freight growth. But we've got to find space on what is a very busy passenger railway to move our freight trains around.
GBRF Chief Executive John Smith was talking to Phil Marsh. Space is also a problem at a depot in East London, where Eurostar maintains its fleet. More operators want to run international services from London, but Temple Mills is the only place, this side of the Channel, where trains built to the larger continental loading gauge can be stabled. The problem is that there is very little spare capacity. Eurostar General Secretary Gareth Williams says demand for international trains is growing.
We see a huge potential for market growth for international cross-channel rail services, you know, up to 50% in the next few years. And we believe that so strongly, we're prepared to invest over £1.5 billion in a new fleet of up to 50 new trains. And that's really a new chapter for international rail. And clearly, us saying that about the market potential, setting that kind of narrative, you know, it has, as it's bound to, attract others who have an interest, other potential competitors who are saying they're also looking at the potential purchase of new trains. They're looking at making significant investments as well. So you've got a situation of significant market growth. You've got Eurostar making a big investment, others about to do the same, a lot of potential new rolling stock coming in, and it obviously poses a challenge of where you maintain those trains in future.
How much spare room is there at Temple Mills?
I think it has been helpful that the regulator undertook the independent capacity survey, which looked exactly at that question. And what it said was that the depot, as it's operated today, is essentially full, but if you did various other things, and they presented a whole range of options, they hadn't costed them or tested them, but they were saying, here are some potential options. If all of those things were possible and it were technically compatible, you would still only generate 1.5 more roads of capacity, you know, which is not enough for any single one of those investments that I was talking about. You know, if you've got Eurostar buying up 50 new trains, you know, a dozen, 17 trains from each competitors, you add all of that up and you've got one road maybe available in depot, it's not going to fit. And that's something that we concluded in relation to our new fleet, that we would have to make an investment in additional capacity. So I don't think we're saying anything different to competitors to what we've been telling ourselves. And I don't think the independent view of capacity concludes anything different either. You know, fundamentally, it says if we are going to unlock this significant growth potential, we need to look for wider solutions.
Gareth Williams, Eurostar General Secretary. The Railway 200 Festival may be arriving at a station near you soon. The exhibition train, Inspiration, started its tour at the end of June when it welcomed visitors at the Severn Valley Railway. Since then, it's been to London, Euston and Waterloo. After that, it's Margate, the Bluebell Railway, and then the greatest gathering at Alstom Derby from the 1st to the 3rd of August, although that one has been booked solid for some time. As Phil Marsh discovered from Engineering Services Director Leven Finney, getting Inspiration ready to meet its public has been a complex job.
So I've got a background in traction and rolling stock. I've worked quite heavily with what we would call our yellow engineering trains. And by chance, understood and heard that this project was taking off. A chance discussion with a couple of our people in Network Rail that had got a real desire to do something different, a real desire to want to inspire the next generation. And the question was, last spring, can we do this? And that sounds great, you know, we'll have a year to do it, but in truth, a year to find suitable rolling stock, to bring it to the standard that we need to operate for just over a year, and then to go about the process to make sure that it is aesthetically correct for what we want to achieve, and to make sure that we can engage with as many people from the local community as possible.
And, of course, everybody will see that they're Mark III coaches, which are probably 50 years old, an ex-charter set. But you've got to go through all the vehicle change stuff because you're kitting it out with non-conforming equipment, if you like. You've got to go through all kinds of acceptance processes, haven't you?
Yeah.
How's that been?
Well, I mean, the train itself's called Inspiration. The theme is past, present, future and railway careers. And I think it's great that we've taken existing rolling stock in the UK, rolling stock that is of a vintage that people will recognise. And we've put materials in it, we've put technologies in it that are absolutely cutting the pace of technology within the industry. The car we're in now has got a drone in here, which we're using to inspect, to help our line side, but even more to just understand the condition of the infrastructure and what goes on. Because if we can see the railway, we can see it in real time, that means that staff don't have to access where trains are running, which makes it safer. But at the same time, it means we can do it quicker. So actually, we don't have the delays that would affect train service. So some of these advanced technologies are showcased on the train, but really the purpose for showcasing it is to give everyone a view of how diverse the railway actually is. It's not just about we have mechanics and we have engineers and we have signalling staff. We have a whole other array of activities and careers that everyone can get involved in.
Leven Finney, who's Engineering Services Director on the Railway 200 exhibition train, talking to Phil Marsh. Finally, there was an event at Paddington Station in London on the 8th of July where a train was named for the late Cyril Bleasdale. He was managing director of Rail News until a year before his death in 2022, but that job came at the end of a varied and successful railway career, which began in 1950. He started as a clerk, but moved steadily up the promotion ladder until he was the first director of Intercity in 1982, and then general manager of the London Midland region, before moving to his last British Rail job, running ScotRail. He was awarded the OBE in 1988 and retired from British Rail in 1994. At Paddington were Chris Green, also a later director of Intercity, and former Eurostar chief executive Richard Brown, who both worked with Cyril at British Rail. Richard Brown remembers that Cyril trusted his staff.
It was frankly great. He was always a very motivating leader. He left you to get on with stuff and encouraged you to get on with stuff. Was happy to sort of throw out new challenges to you. So, yeah, I loved working for him.
He was good at delegating, is that right?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I remember I worked for him several times. First of all, at Freightliner, when I first went to Freightliner, he was MD. He gave me my first job there. And in a second job, I remember we were having a conversation about graduate recruitment, and I was being, as a very recent graduate, quite critical of the way your Freightliner was doing it, and he was bemoaning it as well. And he said, "Okay, you organise it next year." And of course, there was already a guy who was organising it in HR. Unfortunately, I managed to build a big relationship with him. He wasn't a graduate, understood that he didn't understand universities and graduates. So we actually made a great pair. But it was typical of Cyril, just throwing it out as a bit of a challenge and as a bit of a test. But I really enjoyed working for him.
British Rail, we're getting there.
I was very much inspired by Cyril as well as working for him. So when he was divisional manager at Doncaster, he appointed me as his young area manager at Hull. And he was really supportive of young people. He believed in developing them. He believed in stretching them. And he believed in working them hard. So we were very clear what he wanted doing. He was inspirational in conversation and in ideas. And he loved listening to other people's ideas and then encouraging them to implement them.
Cyril, to judge by his autobiography, wasn't terribly interested in railways for their own sake. It was running a business that appealed to him.
Now, yes.
What was he like as a railwayman?
Absolutely fine. So he knew quite enough about the railway to hold his own. He'd been an operational inspector and operations manager in the East Midlands. He'd come up the hard way as a clerk in Liverpool and then became operational. But you're absolutely right. He was made for the new business world that Bob Reid was trying to create on the railway. He loved doing deals. And he loved exploiting new ideas. And a good example was when he went to Freightliners as managing director of Freightliners. He had a new product. He had a lot of freedom to develop it. And he was absolutely the right man for that job. He was literally across the world doing deals in the Far East. It was he that spotted that the future was in deep sea containers, not in the domestic containers, which we were carrying around before. And he's been proved absolutely right. And Freightliners now is the biggest freight operator in the country, very much thanks to Cyril's original business acumen.
What changes did he make that you remember?
I think we should all remember Cyril at Intercity. He was the first true Intercity director of a business. And I was the final one. I had to shut it down before closure. And only then did I realize how much Cyril had done for us. So he created the Intercity brand in its true form. He encouraged television advertising. He went for high service standards in customer service. And he did all sorts of things like bringing back the Pullman trains, relaunching the Sabre tickets, introducing payphones on trains, first class lounges, which is still very successful today on the stations. Those wonderful TV adverts of "we're getting there" and that aeroplane that changed into a train in front of our eyes.
I was quite choked up at one point because there was the engine and I knew what we were there for. And it was quite overwhelming in a way. But then we moved on into the ceremony and GWR did their usual faultless organisation. And they've been tremendous all the way through. So it's been a sort of joint partnership between GWR and myself.
What would Cyril have made of it?
He would be jolly cross he missed the party, I can tell you that, because he was very, very keen on parties.
He was one of the major founders of Rail News. back in 1996, I think.
Yes, I well remember that first meeting in our house when it was the launch, if you like, of Rail News. And yeah, I mean, we took it from there.
Was it good fun to come along today?
It was amazing fun. And to have all your friends grouped together in support, many of whom I made in the last 3 years, plus all of the people from our past, our joint past, it's been incredible.
Cyril's wife, Katie, who named the train at Paddington, and we also heard from Richard Brown and Chris Green. The event at Paddington ended with Cyril's newly named Intercity Express departing at 12:35 for Exeter St. David's, with a piper to mark its departure. And that is where we will depart for now. I'm Sim Harris, this is Rail News, thank you for listening, and thank you to all our contributors. Until next time, goodbye.